From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Jack Holland. He grew up in Northern Ireland. After writing about the Troubles for many years, he's now writing about the peace process for the Irish-American paper, The Irish Echo. We'll talk about the latest step in the peace process, last week's election of members of a new legislature. And we'll hear about Holland's own experiences growing up in a mixed family of Catholics and Protestants. Later, we'll check in again with journalist Orville Schell, who's in China, covering President Clinton's visit. Schell is the author of several books about China. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. An American F-16 fighter jet fired on an Iraqi missile site today. The plane was accompanying a flight of British jets enforcing the no-fly zone over southern Iraq. Sergeant Frank Lehew is with the U.S. Central Command in Florida. He says it was an Iraqi move that prompted today's action.
At approximately 1:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, our coalition aircraft pilots, they received cockpit indications that they were being targeted by an Iraqi missile site. This is considered an action requiring aggressive defensive measures.
Sergeant Lehew says all Allied planes returned safely to base. The Pentagon reports the incident was near Basra. The Pentagon also adds the action is standard procedure when Iraqi radar locks on to NATO aircraft. Taiwan surfaced again today in President Clinton's trip to China. In response to concerns in both Taiwan and China about U.S. policy, the president repeated his commitment to a one-China policy. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
During a roundtable discussion with community leaders at the Shanghai Library, President Clinton repeated what he'd said only a few days ago. He said his administration does not support independence for Taiwan, or two Chinas, or one Taiwan, one China. Mr. Clinton also said the U.S. does not believe Taiwan should be a member in any organization for which statehood is a requirement, and he added that the only U.S. policy on reunification is that it be done peacefully. Before Mr. Clinton left for China, Taiwan suggested that during the trip, the U.S. might reconsider or alter its long-standing China-Taiwan policy. During the visit, Chinese officials also asked about U.S. policy on the issue. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Shanghai.
Talks have resumed between the United Auto Workers Union and General Motors in an effort to end strikes at two GM parts plants. Chief negotiators from each side met yesterday. Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET reports.
The top negotiators from GM and the UAW met for the first time in 2 weeks yesterday, providing signs that the two sides may be more interested in resolving the labor dispute. GM's Gerald Nechtel and UAW Vice President Richard Shoemaker met for about 90 minutes. There's no word on how the meeting went. Separate talks held at the two striking Flint, Michigan parts plants have been unproductive in recent weeks. Key issues include job security, outsourcing, and plant efficiency. 9,200 UAW members went on strike earlier this month at the Flint Metal Center in the Delphi East Complex. The resulting shortage of parts has crippled GM vehicle production in North America. Nearly 163,000 hourly employees have been idled by the strikes. For NPR News, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 53 points at 8,944. Trading is moderate. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, some mild profit-taking has hit the market today, and traders are keeping an eye on events on the world stage and in the United States. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The news that a U.S. warplane had fired on an Iraqi radar site gave Wall Street some pause, though reaction was fairly modest. Stocks, after moving higher shortly after the open, lost ground as investors reacted to that news. Also being closely watched, a two-day meeting by the Federal Reserve Board's Open Market Committee. That got underway here in Washington today. Most analysts expect the Fed will leave interest rates alone for now, though. On the corporate front, Hilton Hotels confirmed today it will split its hotel and gaming operations and pay just over $1 billion for the gambling operations of Grand Casinos. And with the second quarter officially ending today, there's likely to be market volatility as money managers sell their losing stocks and add top performers to their portfolios. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Pan Am Airlines is back in business again. A judge has approved a plan to sell what little remains of the carrier to Guilford Transportation Industries, a New England rail operator. Guilford plans to continue flying charter operations launched after regular flights were canceled in February. Scheduled passenger service may resume in about 1 year. Employment at Pan Am has been cut from 1,400 to 130. The Conference Board says consumer confidence has risen to a new high. The index moved up 1.3% to 137.6, the highest in 29 years. A spokeswoman for the trade group says the improvement comes despite continuing turmoil in Asia and growing questions about the strength of the stock market. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up 53 points. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After years of writing about Northern Ireland's troubles, Jack Holland has been reporting on the peace process. He writes for the Irish-American paper The Irish Echo, which is based in New York. Holland grew up in Northern Ireland in a mixed family of Catholics and Protestants. He's lived in New York since the 70s, but usually returns to Northern Ireland several times a year. Last week, Northern Ireland took a big step forward in the peace process by electing a new assembly, which will restore local government there for the first time since the British imposed direct rule in 1972. The Northern Ireland Assembly was called for by the peace agreement, which was approved in the spring, and designed for Protestants and Catholics to share power. Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, won 18 seats. The remainder of the 108 seats were divided among Protestant parties. I asked Jack Holland what the election results reveal about the way people in Northern Ireland are thinking.
They're part of a pattern that has emerged over the last 30 years anyway. And they show that the Unionist, the Protestant community, is deeply divided as to whether or not they want to support this initiative, whereas the Nationalist or Catholic section of the population seems fairly unified on backing the peace process and this particular stage of it. It has shown a further splintering of the Ulster Unionist vote. There are now at least four Unionist parties in Northern Ireland, and they're squabbling and fighting among themselves as to whether or not they should support the Belfast Agreement and the Assembly, which is a direct result of it.
Do you think that the division within the Protestants can hold up any progress that the National Assembly can make? Will they kind of like divide the vote in such a way as to cripple it?
It's possible. The Reverend Ian Paisley, who since 1965 or 66 has represented the most extreme wing of evangelical unionism, has come out of this election stronger than anyone predicted. He's been in permanent opposition to any attempt to build a bridge between the nationalist and the unionist community. And his party returned 20 seats in the assembly. Add to that some around about eight other anti-agreement candidates who got elected. And that gives him a block of 28. And that could be enough to cause disruption. That would give them enough seats to force the assembly or the executive, which will be the governing body of the assembly, to debate very divisive issues, and could, you know, throw a spanner in the works.
Are there former bomb throwers among both the IRA leaders and the Protestant leaders who are now in this new assembly, who are now legislators instead of bomb throwers?
Well, I wouldn't say they were bomb throwers. There is one called Gerry Kelly who was elected to a seat in North Belfast. Now, the reason I wouldn't call him a bomb thrower is the bomb he was responsible for was too big for any one person to lift. It was at least 200 pounds, which in 1973 was set off in London and injured 250 people and killed. I think one man died as a result of the explosion. Mm-hmm. That was the first provisional IRA attack in England. And he and a team of IRA operatives from Belfast were responsible for it. Yes, there are, in other words, there are, put it more simply, there are former terrorists or freedom fighters or whatever you want to call them, depending on your perspective, who are now getting ready to take their seats in the government of a state which they had sworn to overthrow by violence.
Are these people you know? Has it been interesting for you to watch them change their point of view?
I've known most of the BN protagonists in the struggle over the years. I knew some of them before they ever became freedom fighters or terrorists. Yes, it is it's sometimes rather hallucinatory. I remember when I was in Washington in 1995 at a conference which was organized by the White House, and they brought over a bunch of ex-paramilitaries from both sides, and they were all sitting around on St. Patrick's evening in the entertainments room of the White House listening to an Irish ballad being sung. And I thought I was hallucinating. There I saw these Ulster loyalists who were, when I had last interviewed them, were planning to bomb Dublin, crying into their Irish whiskey, as a well-known Irish tenor, Frank Patterson, sang The Rose of Tralee. And they were sitting not far from the president and his wife, and John Hume, the moderate Catholic leader. Gerry Adams was there, and it was as if someone had dropped a hallucinatory drug into my drink. You know, I said, "What the hell are all these people doing in the one room?" But of course, that has been one of the great triumphs of the peace process. It has been that it has brought together, and under some auspices anyway, men that had been sworn enemies for a long, long time.
What do you think it is that makes a man change like that?
Prison, being in jail for 17 or 18 years can do wonders for your grasp on reality. It can make you confront certain things. I mean, if you have a capacity to change at all, if you have any kind of imagination, if you're not a complete moron, then a long period in prison will give you time to contemplate and to think about your feelings and your anger and your hostility, and try to put it in some perspective. And this is more true of the loyalists, the Protestant paramilitaries. Republicans tend to have a much more fixed ideological analysis, and when they end up in jail, they sort of expect to end up in jail because they regard themselves as revolutionaries, whereas the Ulster Protestants, it's been much more traumatic for them to go to jail. After all, they thought that Northern Ireland was their state, and here they are behind bars in the state that they had sworn to defend. And so it presents a kind of personal crisis for them. And people like John White, who's a prominent member of one of the loyalist political parties, who went to jail for 17 years after having been convicted of a horrendous crime, a multiple murder, is now one of the most outspoken advocates of cross-community cooperation and bridge-building, all the clichés. And he went through that change by going into jail and by meeting and talking with members of the Republican movement, the IRA. And he had a lot of time to think about it, and he was intelligent enough to realise that the actions that he was responsible for were only going to end in disaster for everyone, and that convinced him that the time had come to make a leap.
My guest is Jack Holland, who writes about Northern Ireland for the Irish Echo, which is an Irish-American paper that's based in New York. I'm wondering how you think the peace process is affecting life in the neighborhood level, on the street level, if people are getting along any better.
Now, in theory, yes, things should change, but it'll take a while. Don't forget, Belfast is a very small city. It's a population of 250,000-300,000. Northern Ireland has a population of 1.5 million, which is half the population of Brooklyn, approximately. People live very close to each other, and the closer you are to someone, the more bitterly you feel towards them when you believe that they have turned on you, or that they're responsible for attacking your street or your home. And the proximity in Belfast is frightening. It's not. It means that old grievances tend to last a long time. People are suspicious of each other, and because the IRA remains armed, has not actually come out and said to anyone that the war is over. The Protestants are deeply suspicious. And because the Protestants still insist on marching through Catholic areas with their parades, the Catholics are extremely hostile still and suspicious of the other community. We have to begin somewhere, and this is as good a beginning as any, but I think that suspicion and hostility will be there for quite a long time.
Isn't the IRA giving something of a mixed message if Sinn Féin, the political wing, is strongly for the peace process, yet the IRA hasn't officially given up its arms or given up violence?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Ulster Unionists have made this point that if Sinn Féin is committed to peaceful politics, why hasn't its armed wing, the IRA, agreed to surrender some of its weapons or decommission them? Republicans will say, of course, well, it takes time. These things don't happen overnight. We've had 30 years of conflict. Some of the issues have still not been resolved. For example, the issue of parades, where the loyalists are allowed to parade and where they're not allowed to parade. And until the Republicans, the Irish Republicans, are confident that the British are going to behave in a fair and balanced way towards both communities, they will not begin the process of disarming.
Next Sunday, there's a big annual march of Protestants, and that march often spills over into a Catholic neighborhood, and then there's always rioting and violence as Catholics and Protestants fight. There was just a parade commission ruling that the Protestant marchers can't march in this Catholic area. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as a positive sign that this clash won't be possible this year because of that ruling, or do you think it's unfortunate that things are so still volatile that a ruling like that needed to be made in the first place?
Well, it's unfortunate that a ruling like that had to be made. But I think it's good for the Catholic community in the sense that it'll be a gesture towards them that we are serious about making you feel equal within the Northern Ireland state to your Protestant neighbours, and we want to prevent marches which are very provocative from going through your areas. It's bad in that a plus for one is always seen as a loss for the other side in Northern Ireland. That's the problem. So the Unionists are now saying that they don't recognise the remit of this commission, which was set up to adjudicate these issues, and are threatening to go ahead with the parade anyway. Now, it's okay for the Parades Commission to take a decision and say you cannot march this route. The real problem is, how is it going to be policed? Because the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which is the Northern Ireland police force, is more than 90% Protestant and is viewed by the Catholic population with deep suspicion. So the RUC will be in the middle, will have to enforce this decision. And it could be a very, very dangerous situation, which could get out of hand if the Unionists do what they say and go ahead and march.
Is the Parade Commission new? Is that also a result
of
the peace process?
Yes, it was set up as a result of the peace process to attempt to give a sort of objective view over these disputes, which could crop up every year around this time.
My guest is journalist, novelist, and poet Jack Holland. He writes for the Irish-American paper, The Irish Echo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Jack Holland. You write now for an Irish-American paper called The Irish Echo. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you think the peace process means to Irish-Americans, if its meaning is different than you think it is in Northern Ireland.
Again, it depends on their politics. I think for the majority of Irish Americans, those that would be readers of the Irish Echo, they welcomed it because they were concerned about the level of bloodshed in Northern Ireland over the years, and they, you know, they didn't like to see their, you know, fellow countrymen killing each other and being killed and involved in gun battles with the British Army and so on. So that was a cause of distress. So I think there's a majority of Irish Americans would welcome the peace process because it has brought an end to that. However, as in Ireland, there is a hard core of Republicans in the United States who are vociferously against it and who denounce it as a sellout, a betrayal of the Irish goal of a united Ireland. And I mean, it's not possible to give an estimation of what percentage they are. It's a small percentage. But as in Ireland, it's enough to cause, for them to draw attention to themselves.
Do you think that there are any clear generational differences in Northern Ireland regarding the peace process?
Yes, there's a striking one that I've noticed within the paramilitary organizations. Those men that are now the leaders of the IRA and the leaders of the various Protestant groups are all men in their early 50s, late 40s, who have all spent 30 years of their lives involved in conflict. A large part of that time they've been in jail. They've all seen many of their friends arrested and killed. Their families have been disrupted. They have seen their lives being rendered very difficult in the lives of those around them. During the emergency, you couldn't go out at night. If you went out, you had to stay within your own area. The town centre of Belfast effectively closed down. People were afraid to go out for a meal. They were afraid to go out to the cinema. Areas were blacked out at times. And so they've been through that, and it has chastened them. And I think that was a tremendous influence on their thinking, and it motivated them to become involved in finding a way out of the situation other than through the gun and the bomb.
You grew up in Belfast. Your family was part Catholic and part Protestant. How did coming from a divided family affect where you stood on the issue of Northern Ireland?
Well, coming from a divided family meant I stood on the fence, or sat on the fence. No, it's not strictly true. I didn't really stand anywhere. I had no interest in Northern Ireland politics. When I was young, I found it excruciatingly boring and excruciatingly predictable. I was much more interested in ancient Rome, and I studied ancient Roman history and ancient Greek history a lot more than I studied Irish history. It's ironic that I've ended up spending the last 25 years or so of my life writing about Northern Ireland. But having Protestants and Catholics in the family, an extended family, it inoculated me, I think, to sectarian feeling. My Protestant uncle, with whom I grew up, was more of an Irish nationalist than my father, who was a Catholic. And it also allowed me to identify, though I grew up in a Catholic area in the end, I spent most of my teenage years in the Falls Road area, which was a solidly Catholic area. But coming from a Protestant background, when I became a journalist, it made it easier for me to go to the Protestant organizations and talk to them, and because my name is a Protestant name, I think they felt more comfortable with me. They trusted me more so, perhaps, than they might have otherwise.
So how did your family break down?
It goes back to my grandparents. My grandfather was a Presbyterian from Port of Down, which is where this march is going to take place next week. And my grandmother was a Catholic who came from the mountains of Mourne in South Down. And when she married, she lapsed. She stopped practicing her religion, and they lived in Protestant areas. So her family were raised. She had seven children. They were raised in loyalist areas of Belfast for most of their lives. And her final child is a very strange story. My father, he was the youngest. When he was born, by accident, he was born in a hospital which was run by nuns. And the story is that the nuns, assuming she was a Catholic, baptized him. And so my grandmother, being superstitious, felt that since he had been baptized a Catholic, she was obliged to bring him up a Catholic. So my father was the by a twist of fate, was raised a Catholic in a Protestant family. So.
Oh, right. So
it's very strange. I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but when he was growing up in the 30s in Belfast, every time the marching season came along, because they lived in a Protestant area, he had to be taken out of town and brought down to his mother's family in the country for his own security, for his safety. Perhaps that's why he became a professional fighter and became an Ulster champion after a while.
Now, did you have friends on each side?
I did actually have neighbours in the street in which I lived, off the Grosvenor Road, who became members of the Ulster Defence Association. But that was after I had lost contact with them. The UDA is the biggest of the loyalist paramilitary organisations. But most of my friends, because I grew up in a mainly Catholic area off the Falls Road, ended up in the Republican movement, one of the various groups, you know, the IRA, or there was the provisional IRA and the official IRA. So I had friends and relations, cousins, who became members of one or other of the Republican organisations. One of them, a cousin of mine, was actually shot dead in 1974 during a dispute within the organisation. I've had several very good friends who have been murdered over the years by Protestant assassination squads.
Now, even though you were trying to be pretty non-sectarian, would it make you more sectarian when a friend of yours was shot?
No, I don't try to be non-sectarian. I just don't feel any sectarian animosity. I never have felt it, because I wasn't. I think to have that kind of hatred, you have to get it from your family. I don't think you get it from the street. It has to be imbued into you at a fairly early age. It's like racism. It's something a child does not feel racist. A child picks it up from his family. Since there was no sectarianism in my family, I just did not understand sectarian animosity. I understood political animosity. I understood why Catholics wanted to change the Northern Ireland state, because it was very unfair to them. I sympathised with that, and I supported that. But I could not understand hatred of Catholics on the Protestant side or hatred of Protestants on the Catholic side. It just was not part of my being. So there was no effort involved in not trying to be sectarian.
Jack Holland writes for the Irish-American paper, The Irish Echo. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Jack Holland. He'll tell us more about growing up in Northern Ireland. Then we'll check in again with journalist Orville Schell. He's in China, covering President Clinton's visit. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist, novelist, and poet Jack Holland. He's in the process of writing a book on the history of the conflict in Northern Ireland. At the same time, he's covering the peace process for the Irish-American paper The Irish Echo. He lives in New York but grew up in Northern Ireland. He was raised Catholic in a mixed family of Catholics and Protestants. I believe you had a cousin who was an H-block prisoner. Was that the...
That's correct, yes.
That was the most, like, extreme prison conditions in
my first cousin was a member of the Provisional IRA and was arrested, and during the prison protests of the late 1970s he became involved in a campaign to restore political status to paramilitary prisoners, and as part of the protest they were locked up in their cells and couldn't go out to empty their chamber pots in the morning, and smeared their excrement on the walls as a way of getting rid of it, I suppose. And that lasted for several years, and he was on that protest for several years. It was horrific.
Did you visit him there, or was there no visiting?
There was no visiting for those prisoners. I visited friends in jail, but I never actually got to visit my cousin.
What did the family experience while he was going through the dirty protest?
Well, his sister is a nun and went to visit him. I think there was attempts to dissuade him in the early stages from being involved in it because they were afraid he would get sick and die. But like many of the Irish Republican prisoners in Long Kesh at the time, he was extremely determined to fight this to the end. And as you know, it actually, after this form of protest had gone on for a while, the hunger strikes began in 1981, which led to the death of 10 prisoners in the maze. They were extremely determined. See, the thing that the British did not understand, and I think they haven't been able to read Irish Republicans very well, is that the Irish Republicans do not see themselves as terrorists. They do not see themselves as criminals. So no matter what the propaganda says about them, you know, describing them as mindless bombers or gunmen, they believe strongly that they are fighting for a legitimate cause and that their violence is part of the methods that they have traditionally employed to fulfill that cause. And the British, I think, fell into their own propaganda, believing that the IRA was just another criminal organization. And if you treated them like criminals, then they would accept it. They didn't understand that that's not what the IRA is. It's a totally different kind of organization. And as a result, of course, they forced these reforms through and ignored the warnings from the IRA that their men in prison would not accept these changes that they were trying to make and would die rather than accept them, which is what happened.
Did your cousin make it out of prison, or did he die inside?
No, he made it out of prison. He came out in 1986, I think. He was in since 1973.
So where is he now vis-a-vis the peace process after having...
Oh, he's totally supportive of Gerry Adams and the Sinn Féin line. He believes... he lives in a working class part of Belfast. He's married. He's got two children. And he is firmly committed to the new strategy which the IRA has adopted, which is a political strategy.
Now, were you the first in your family to go to college?
I'm the first and I'm the only one so far. There are five of us. I've got a brother and three sisters. I'm the only one to go to university so far.
Were your parents proud of that? Did they want you to do that?
No, they didn't particularly want me to go to university. I didn't grow up with my parents. I spent most of my life with my grandmother. My father he was a working class man. I told you he was a boxer. My mother worked in a shirt factory. Education to them was finished by the age of 13. Then when they left school, they had to go to work. They were very poor, and their families needed the income, however small. And they regarded me going to university as something of a luxury. I was fortunate that I got a scholarship to go to university. But even so, they weren't too excited about the fact that I was not going to be earning a wage by the time I was 16 or 17. Though they did in the end come around to accept it. And my mother, of course, is very happy that I've gone on to publish books about Northern Ireland and to write about the situation. My father's dead now, but he was always, I mean, working class Catholics and Protestants do share something in common, and they tend to be very conservative. They resist change at a social level, at a moral level, and to him, university was just something that he had never experienced. He didn't know, he couldn't relate to it. It was a different world. It was a world of the middle classes. And one of the striking things about Belfast is the difference between working class and middle class cultures. There's a huge gulf. I mean, there's a greater difference, as I keep saying to my friends over here, between working class and middle class in Belfast than there is between African Americans and white Americans here. They have more in common than working class people have with middle class people. They just don't interact. They live in separate areas. They speak a different kind of English. They move in separate circles. They have totally different kinds of employment. And they drink in different bars. It's the segregation between the classes there is as noticeable as the separation between Catholic and Protestant.
How old were you when you came to the United States, and what was behind your decision to come here?
I married a woman from New York, Mary Hudson, and I first came to live here in 1977. I had made several visits to New York over the years and had fallen in love with it. I was a New Yorker, but I just happened to be born in Belfast, I decided. There are New Yorkers who just are unfortunate not to be born in New York, in Bombay or Cairo or Paris. I happened to be born in Belfast, but as soon as I came here, I realized that this was the city that I felt most comfortable in. And we married, and we eventually came back here to live in 1977.
Was it only after you moved here that you started writing about Northern Ireland politics?
No, I had worked as a journalist for the BBC in Belfast, BBC Television. And before that, I had worked on a magazine as an investigative journalist. I did a lot of my work on terrorism.
How optimistic are you now that the peace process will keep moving forward and that things will resolve?
I'm very optimistic. I'm a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist. I think the Belfast Agreement, as it's called, laid the foundations for a long-term settlement to the Northern Ireland problem. The difficulties are now involved in building upon that foundation, and there are going to be problems, as we have. You know, as I said at the beginning, the unionists are dubious still and suspicious. Those suspicions will have to be overcome. But I think we have entered a new stage in the history of Northern Ireland, perhaps the final stage, and it will result in the end in a peaceful settlement.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Jack Holland is writing a history of the conflict in Northern Ireland. He writes for the Irish-American paper, The Irish Echo. Coming up, we check in with journalist Orville Schell in Beijing. He's following President Clinton on his tour. This is Fresh Air. After covering China since the 1960s, journalist Orville Schell is quite surprised by some of what he's seen and heard over the last week in China as he's followed President Clinton on his tour. Schell didn't expect that the president would have the opportunity twice to address the Chinese people directly in live TV broadcasts, first in a debate with the president of China, Jiang Zemin, then in a question and answer session with students at Beijing University. We spoke with Schell last week from Xi'an, just before Clinton's arrival. We called Schell again early this morning in Beijing. Schell is the author of several books about China and is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. I asked him which comments by President Clinton have had the greatest impact in China.
Well, I think just to hear a leader from afar standing beside the leader of China and raising the question of the Beijing massacre and the demonstrations in 1989, raising the question of human rights, raising the question of Tibet in a very collegial way. And then to see the leader of China not freeze in defensiveness, but actually parry the blow in a way. I think that was very surprising for Chinese. It was certainly surprising for Westerners. But I think what it represented was, and why it was so significant, even though nothing quite was agreed to, was that it represented one of the very first times that a Chinese leader has not been defensive. And so much of China's posture, I think really since the Opium War, has been very defensive. It has been, they easily get in this victim syndrome where the West is beating up on them and Japan is occupying them. But here was President Zhang going blow for blow with Clinton in a friendly way on the most sensitive and delicate issues, which everybody had skirted around in public diplomatic exchanges previously.
Do you think that this says something about the direction China is heading in, or just something about President Zhang?
Well, that's a very interesting question. As I sat in that room, and then 2 days later out at Beijing University, where Clinton again made an address that was publicly broadcast all across the country, it did occur to me that something was changing of a rather tectonic nature in China, as it periodically does, or President Zhang was opening himself to some risk of seeming to run possibly under the skirts of the West, which is a place that a Chinese leader does not want to be because of the great sensitivity to seeming to either submit to the West or to be too enamored of the West. And yet this is what happened, and I wondered and still do wonder the dangers of him going too far, because behind him is sort of the part of the iceberg or underneath him that's underwater we can't see. And, you know, we forget at our peril that this place had a communist revolution that lasted for four decades, and many people consecrated themselves to it wholeheartedly, and many people were shaped by it and still contain sort of the recessive genes of that revolution in there, the way they look at the world and don't shine kindly on people who run off and dance with American presidents in too profligate a way.
Do you have any clue what happened behind the scenes when the Clinton administration people were trying to convince Chinese officials to broadcast the debate with President Zhang and the Clinton address before Beijing University?
Well, this was a very important point to President Clinton because, I mean, he has to defend himself against critics in the American Congress. And what good does it do if he comes and says a few things and no one ever hears about it? So they didn't know, and we didn't know, when we went into the Great Hall of the People to sit down in this room, whether, in fact, this was being broadcast. In fact, most of us thought it was very, very unlikely that it would be. It was only when the thing ended that we learned that it had gone out all across the country. I mean, and they estimate, you know, around 600 million viewers. Not a bad viewing audience. So this was quite a concession that the Chinese made, but interestingly enough, just to so that we don't lose touch with the fact that they still feel very sensitive about these sorts of expressions, the newspapers the next day did not print any of the loaded, sensitive discussion. They had an expurgated version that went out over the New China News Agency. So, I mean, it's what we also see is that the media can be divided into different sections, and just because the president says broadcast this, it doesn't mean that everybody else will jump too and do the same sort of dissemination. And this is a classic pattern that different parts of the media fight with each other because maybe they're more conservative and they really didn't want to be the vectors of this new kind of openness.
I remember the first time we spoke during this trip to China, you said that a friend of yours had suggested that Hillary Clinton wear white at Tiananmen Square because white is actually the color of mourning in China. Mourning M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, and that that would be a kind of silent but symbolic protest of the government crackdown at Tiananmen Square in 1989. So what did she wear?
Well, she did not wear white. I think she wore a pantsuit, if recollection serves. And, I mean, indeed, this trip has been not exactly replete with efforts to meet the opposition, to meet dissidents. I mean, for instance, the former premier and party chief who was cashiered in 1989 went to the square and with tears in his eyes said to the students late one night, you know, we've come too late, and then vanished. Well, he's been under house arrest for 9 years, is probably the most famous political prisoner in China, never charged, never tried, just put in his house. There's been no talk about him, no effort to see him. I guess the feeling has been, as ever, that you can only push it so far without getting back into that sensitive territory where the Chinese will start bucking and bridling, and you won't have enough engagement and sort of a fund of friendship to be able to get any momentum forward on these issues. And this, of course, is a subject of enormous contention back home as to whether Clinton should have missed this opportunity to symbolically cast some attention on people who had kids killed in 89 or dissidents or people who've been in prison, are in prison.
So tell us a little bit about your adventures traveling around with the press through China during Clinton's trip.
Well, it's like being on some cruise ship in a way. Including what one photographer friend of mine calls the death by buffet, because wherever we land, there is a hotel that's taken over. There's this huge room where all of the members of the press have a phone and have a little place to sit to file. It's a filing center. And then outside, there are tables groaning with chafing dishes and pastries and everything under the sun 24 hours a day. And you are sort of, it's like being in a harem. You're kept in here, and people don't very often get out except for when the buses will take you to a president's speech, to the square, for some official event, and there's very little time to get out, and most of the press can't speak Chinese, and they don't know really where they are, and so they're kind of victims of this very closed environment, and sort of get moved around with great efficiency by the White House travel office and the people who are handling the press and taking us to all these events. So there's a kind of an air of unreality about it all, and you can go to city after city and never quite get your feet wet in anything but this sort of prearranged and very well-organized juggernaut of a press tour.
Where have you gone off the beaten track?
Well, I often will try to slip out and, you know, go to a little restaurant and talk with people or at Beijing University to speak with students after he addressed them. And, you know, he was quoting Ben Franklin about the need for criticism, that critics are our best allies because they help us see where we are wrong and change. I went out and wandered around the campus a bit and talked to students. And it was very interesting. He then gave a whole bunch of books to the Beijing University Library, and exactly on the place where this little ceremony was conducted, out in front of the new wing of the library donated by this Hong Kong billionaire. There used to be this gargantuan concrete statue of Chairman Mao that a number of years ago they put a stick of dynamite in and blew up and hauled off one night. But everywhere you go, unless you've been around, you don't quite see the history, and you don't know how the place has changed, how the imagery has changed, how the ideology has changed. And, of course, this is the real, really perplexing thing for me about China, is how can a country and a society change its identity so that, you know, at one point not so long ago, you have Chairman Mao exhorting everybody to punch the air with their red Bibles and promote class struggle. And then suddenly we have Bill Clinton out there quoting Ben Franklin and talking about, you know, pluralism and democracy. if it's bewildering to us, imagine what it's like to Chinese who are trying to figure out, in effect, what does it mean to be Chinese? What's the core value of this whole enterprise?
My guest is journalist Orville Schell, who's in Beijing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the conversation we recorded early today with journalist Orville Schell in Beijing. When we spoke last week, shortly after you arrived in China, you were telling us a little bit about some of the changes that you were seeing in China since your last trip there. Tell us more about changes that you've seen that are surprising.
Well, you know, I have this feeling about China that at last it's becoming a normal country. It was a little... Before, I don't know what the analogy was. The only one I can think of, and it's a kind of a comical one, was that the China was something like the Coneheads on Saturday Night Live. I mean, they were pretending that nobody noticed, you know, that they were somehow from another world, and they were claiming to be from France. China just didn't seem normal. It didn't relate to other people in a kind of a friendly, open, spontaneous way. Its leaders were somehow isolated. They spoke in a strange jargon. It was very hard to get through to them. People were standoffish. You never knew quite how to read the situation. And the truth was, people were afraid. And now there's this great sigh of relaxation. And it's as if you see the human side of people. They don't seem so sort of extraterrestrial in some other inexplicable world that you can't quite understand. Cafes are opening everywhere in Beijing and Shanghai now, little dives, and there's music. In fact, the hotel I'm in now, I was just coming up through the lobby, and I heard someone playing stride piano in the lounge, and walked over, and it was a young Chinese man playing very well. They're the first gay clubs have opened up. We're beginning to get a kind of a growth of the margins, a world where people can be who they are, where they're not harassed, a whole expansion of areas of freedom, which do not, alas, extend into public expressions of political sentiment. And this is the rub. The party has circled the wagons around a smaller circumference of taboo territory, but it happens to involve the rights of people to say something about how they are governed and to participate in their governance.
What do you think the after effects of this trip might be on relations between China and the United States?
Well, I think they're going to be much warmer, and I do think that... Because of the personal relationship, and because in fact Clinton has given Jiang Zemin faith, something will come back. There is always payments. The question is, what will the payment be, and how far can Jiang Zemin go to repay his new friend Bill Clinton without antagonizing this very strange, you know, stage crew, cast of characters that exists behind the stage sets on which this week was played? And this is a very, very complicated set of political factions. It has many very conservative strains in it, and as I suggested earlier, does not always take kindly to profligate expressions of friendship with foreign powers.
But they made each other look good. President Clinton made President Zheng look good by just by being there, right? And by having this open communication. And President Zheng made Clinton look good by giving him access to live television and not censoring what he said.
Well, I think Zheng got more out of it than Clinton did. But I think that was always in the game, that Clinton was going to give this to him. He was going to give him this face, give him this relationship in this 9 days, and see if that could sort of beef up the, quote, relationship to the point where we might actually be able to get some progress. But, you know, we love to think of China as an authoritarian dictatorship with a big ruler at the top who just can pull levers and make things happen, but it doesn't happen that way. For instance, in Shanghai today, there's a big rhubarb going on because there's a Chinese Kunqu opera troupe that's been training to go to Lincoln Center. And they're supposed to open on July 7th to do the Peony Pavilion. And there's some very conservative person in the cultural bureau there in Shanghai won't let them go because thinks the opera's too salacious. Who knows what's going on? There's a big beef going on. There's a big mess. And it's a reminder that beneath the surface, there are forces at work that even the Communist Party chief really has no control over.
One of the things this shows is that even if the president is trying to open up a little bit, there are so many people on a kind of lower scale in the power pyramid who will still be really happy to exert their power in petty ways and to censor things in any way that they can on their level.
It's absolutely true. And one of the things that's happening in China is a kind of a feudalization of the country, so that cities or provinces or even counties have an enormous amount of power now, which derives basically from their economic power. And people in Beijing really don't have the ability to tell them what to do. And moreover, they're very loath to try, because if they fail, it would be a public demonstration of their weakness. So I think their attitude most often, and this goes for the arrest of dissidents too, better say nothing so people don't see that you can't actually affect national policy on a local level.
Orville Schell spoke to us from Beijing. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. Schell's books about China include Discos and Democracy and Mandate of Heaven. He's currently writing a book about Tibet and Western images of it. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.